Welcome to the latest episode of Take Back Our Schools, along with Beth Feely. I am Andrew Gutman. We are two accidental activist parents that spoke up about what was going on in our own kids' schools. And today we're going to talk to someone who wrote a book about some of the other parents in this parents' movement, and not just parents, that also spoke up and helped form this parents' movement. So we are very pleased to welcome Lance Azumi to today's show. Lance is the senior director of the Center for Education at the Pacific Research Institute. He is the former two-term president of the Board of Governors of the California Community Colleges, the largest system of higher education in the country, and co-author of the book I just mentioned, The Great Parent Revolt: How Parents and Grassroots Leaders Are Fighting Critical Race Theory in America's Schools. Lance, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much, Andrew. It's great to be on your podcast with you and with Beth. And you know, it's I've heard such great things about your podcast, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, so are we. So let's talk about the book that you co-authored. I mean, what was sort of the inspiration for writing a book that featured a lot of the parent, you know, the people that formed this parents' movement?
Well, you know, I think that one of the things that we were thinking about when we decided to do this book, The Great Parent Revolt, is that there have been a number of books that have been released on this issue of critical race theory, and we could get into what critical race theory actually means. But you know, a lot of the books that have been released so far have oftentimes been kind of academic works where you have kind of folks in ivory towers arguing with other folks in other ivory towers about critical race theory and kind of the finer points of it. And what we thought was missing from this was, you know, what was going on with the people who are truly experiencing this, the parents who were, who had kids in their schools who were having to undergo critical race theory curriculum, exercises, and the whole works, right? And so we decided that what would be actually helpful for people, for readers, would be to profile the experiences of parents from coast to coast here in America, you know, from Rhode Island to California, to tell them, you know, what the story of these people were. These are really ordinary people who have risen to do really extraordinary things in order to fight critical race theory in their kids' classrooms, fight district bureaucracies, and fight all kinds of education deep state interests out there in order to get a better education for their kid, to ensure a transparency and accountability. And, you know, I think that what people want nowadays, especially in these gloomy times, is some inspirational stories. And that's what we wanted to provide, because these aren't just parents who are, being overwhelmed by the critical race theory. They're actually winning. And we wanted to present those winning stories to people to show that, hey, it is possible for, as I say, ordinary people to do extraordinary things as long as they're committed to ensuring that their kids get the best education possible.
So who are some of these parents that you highlight in the book?
Well, you know, we have like a broad gamut. And then one of the things that we wanted to ensure is that we wanted to show that the folks who are against critical race theory, parents, you know, span the broad gamut. And it's not just geographically, but from every religious, ethnic, racial, socioeconomic category. And so that's what we did. The people who are against critical race theory are not just a narrow slice of America. And so, for example, one of the parents, the first parent that we profile in the book is a woman named Gabs Clark, who is African-American mom, low income, mother of five, widowed, was on disability, and was so poor, actually, that she was living in a motel in Las Vegas. And, and you might think that she would be kind of the last person who would end up becoming a hero against critical race theory. But again, you know, this is a story of somebody who saw what was going on in their children's classrooms and decided that they needed to take action. Specifically in her case, her son was forced to be in a particular class in the school that was required for graduation. It was called the Sociology of Change. And in this class, you know, he had to do some critical race theory inspired lessons, including identifying himself based upon all these different identifying traits such as race, religion, gender, sexuality, all these sorts of things. And he had to then, you know, present that in his class, and he didn't want to. And especially because Gab's son is mixed race. Gab's is African American, but her son's father was white. He's now deceased, unfortunately. But because her son had white features, blonde hair, blue eyes, that he felt that he would be picked on or targeted if he was forced to continue in this exercise, and he refused. And because he refused to continue that exercise, he received a failing grade in that class. And because that class was a requirement for graduation, he did not receive his diploma. And Gab said that, you know, that's too much. You can't deny my child this, you know, his graduation diploma because he stood up for himself. And so therefore she filed a federal lawsuit against the school, saying that the school violated her son's First Amendment free speech rights, the 14th Amendment, her son's 14th Amendment equal protection rights, and rights under various federal statutes, such as the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And so, you know, again, this is a story of a person who, you know, she was so poor that she had to decide between buying gasoline and food for her kids and for her family. And yet, you know, because her son's future was at stake, she decided to file this lawsuit against the school. The school eventually settled. But I just think it just shows, you know, the lengths to which parents are willing to defend their children against this type of indoctrination and this type of bullying from official sources.
You talked about the diversity of all these parents, geographically, socioeconomically, I'm guessing politically. Is there anything that, in doing the research and talking to these people that they all had in common, other than just obviously wanting to protect their children?
Well, you know, I think that a lot of them, you know, were from immigrant backgrounds. And that's what's interesting about this is that, you know, the people who are in favor of critical race theory will often have, informed person think that, well, you know, they're the ones protecting immigrants. But it turns out that immigrants are actually the ones who are most offended by critical race theory because they have seen what has gone on in their home countries that they left. And so, for example, we profile a mom named G. Van Fleet, who is a mom who left China, communist China. And she actually, as a little girl, experienced the Maoist Cultural Revolution, which killed millions of ordinary Chinese people based upon the fact that people simply belong, according to the communists, to unfavored classes, that they had personal family histories that the communists didn't like, or that they adhered to certain traditions that the communists didn't like. And so she saw all of this go on, and a lot of that cultural revolution went on in the schools. And she saw, for example, when she was a little girl, propaganda posters being put up, which advocated for the persecution of people based upon the fact that they may have belonged to different classes that the communists wanted to persecute. And she saw a particular instance where a teacher in her school actually, you know, simply did her hair in kind of a nice way, but in a way, in a style that the communists didn't like. And she was set upon by all these young Red Guards, Mao's, stormtroopers, basically. And and these Red Guards all spit on her, like dozens of these Red Guards just spit on her till she was covered from head to toe with spit. And that left a lasting impression on Xi. And she, what she says is that when she looks at what happened in the Cultural Revolution with all of this persecution, this totalitarian repression of the Chinese people, it was all because of the Marxist separation of people into oppressor and oppressed classes based upon the economic status. And that's classical Marxism. So you had the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, and that's what the Maoist Red Guards were going after, what they perceived as the oppressive bourgeoisie class. Well, what she sees here in the United States with critical race theory, where instead of separating people into different classes based upon economic status, you're separating them based upon race, so that oppressor classes are viewed as white people and oftentimes Asian people as well. And the oppressed class being non-white people, that, you know, she feels as though America is recreating that Maoist nightmare that she escaped. And so she stood up, you know, in she's just this immigrant Chinese mom in Loudoun County. And she stood up and, you know, went to school board meetings and actually became fairly well known nationally because of that, because she was able to testify to a firsthand experience of what totalitarianism really looks like and how it is starting to fester here in America, just like in communist China.
And she wasn't treated all that nicely for making that observation, as I recall. This was during COVID, right? Was this the kind of the outset? So she was a part of that wave of people that woke up. When did you start noticing that our schools had kind of veered off track in this way? Because you've been in education policy and observing the industry for a while. When did you see the beginnings of this?
Well, I think it's important for people to realize that this is not something that is a new phenomenon. I mean, we're seeing a lot of the manifestations of this phenomenon now. But if you, you know, dig deep and look at where the genesis of this started, it goes back decades. And so I'll just point one example. In my work at the Pacific Research Institute, you know, I've been with Pacific Research Institute now for close to three decades. And one of the first studies that I actually ever did for Pacific Research Institute was an analysis of the teacher training curriculum at the California State University system. And what I found in that study is, when you looked at all the different types of required books, that a lot of these concepts that we're talking about now with critical race theory in terms of this racial Marxism were present in the teacher training books that were part of the curriculum for the prospective teachers, you know, two decades ago. And so, you know, so it's no surprise then that, yes, you know, we're seeing this explosion, you know, in critical race theory now. But then so many people within public education and also private education, to be fair, you know, have bought into this. And, you know, it's not just the youngest teachers, you know, it's teachers who have been there for a while. But and why is that? It's because, again, they've been trained, you know, through the teacher schools of education to, you know, basically indoctrinated in this critical race theory. I mean, people like us have often said that the left has conducted a long march through the institutions. And this is evidence of that. And so what started off as maybe theorizing in schools of education have now come to fruition in terms of what's going on in our classrooms. Thankfully, however, parents are fighting back, which is why, you know, we wrote this book in order to show that, yes, the education deep state has pushed this into the schools, but parents are fighting back, not just people like G. Van Fleet and Gabs Clark, but a whole array of different people and using different strategies in order to fight back to protect their children.
So you've been noticing this, you know, the long march through the institutions, the germination of these ideas in teachers' colleges as they flow through the schools for decades. Are you surprised it took so long for parents to wake up to this? And was it just COVID that they could see, you know, on Zoom what their kids were learning? I mean, you think that was really what instigated this movement?
I think that's a lot of it, actually, Andrew. You know, this thing had been, you know, seeping in to the system. But I think that, you know, parents, you know, oftentimes, you know, they with the best of intentions, they drop their kids off at school and they just assume that their kids are, you know, learning ABC, not CRT, you know. And so, you know, they don't expect their kids are going to be indoctrinated in the classes. I mean, that's not what they're paying their tax dollars. At least that's what they think they're not paying their tax dollars for. And so, yeah, you know, I think that parents, unfortunately, were in the dark about what was going on. And really, COVID really was the, you know, kind of the epiphany that dropped the scales from their eyes And so they were able to, you know, look over the shoulder of their children, see what was going in the classroom, and in many cases then be activated. And I'll go back to Gabs Clark as an example again. You know, she first became aware of what was going on in her children's classes when she looked over the shoulder of her youngest daughter, who was doing a Zoom class during COVID. And she saw that the teacher was pushing Black Lives Matter stuff. And this was in an art class. And so she was saying, well, what is my daughter learning about Black Lives Matter stuff in an art class? And what does this have to do with her education? And so she was very adamant when she went to the principal and talked that, you know, I don't want to see this sort of thing. And so, again, that was like her first awakening that something rotten was going on in her children's school. And again, it was then confirmed when she found out about what was happening to her son at the high school level. But, you know, her daughter, when she was in this art class, was only 12 years old. So that's the kind of thing that, you know, I think parents saw all across America. What happened to Gabs is something that you saw in classrooms and schools all across the country where people became aware of what was going on, and they decided that they needed to become more activists. And you saw that in these packed school board meetings, where previously you might have had only one or two members of the public show up, and now, you know, it was standing room only. And I think that's what happened.
Yeah. Well, and I started this in late 2016, 2017, and I had never been to a school board meeting before I kind of woke up to some things happening in my kids' school. So it is a little trial by fire. I mean, it's intimidating. There's a lot to take in. There's a lot of emotion because it's your kids. So, you know, in terms of some of the strategies that people have employed, what do you think is most effective? Do you think it's showing up at these meetings? Do you think it's lawsuits? Is it all of the above?
Well, I think that one of the things that, you know, first of all, parents need to do is really find out what exactly is going on in the kids' classrooms. You know, it's great if you happen to have caught that glimpse in, let's say, a Zoom class that your kid was doing. But if your kid is coming home and saying, hey, you know, there's some weird stuff going on in my class, and, you know, there are weird teachings going on, you know, and the parent then tries to find out what exactly is going on, you know, oftentimes they'll be stonewalled. And one of the things that we do in our book is we profile different parents who have used public records requests and Freedom of Information Act requests in order to force the school districts, to divulge what is actually being taught in their classrooms. We profile a mom from Rhode Island named Nicole Solis. And Nicole, had problems with what she thought was being taught to her daughter in her elementary school. And when she confronted the principal and started questioning the principal said to her, well, go file a public records request. Well, he picked the wrong person to say that to, because Nicole then went out and eventually filed 160 public records requests, you know, to force the school to divulge what was actually being taught in the classroom. And she was very specific. She wasn't like out there on a fishing expedition. She was very specific in the types of things she was asking for, so that the school couldn't dance around what she was asking. And I think what this shows is that, first of all, that how parents are very thoughtful about how they're getting this information, but also too, in this particular instance, how the schools reacted. So the school, which had originally through the principal said, go file a public records request. Well, when she eventually filed all of these requests, the school district threatened to sue her for filing these public records requests. This is public information, and she's entitled to it. But the school district threatened to sue her because of that. They eventually backed down. But I think that's an indication about how they want to keep this indoctrination secret from the parents. And we also highlight a profile, a parent named Kelly Shankowski, who is in Monterey County across the country here in my home state of California. And, you know, in California, the legislature and the governor have passed a law requiring ethnic studies as a requirement in our school system. Well, she wanted to see how that requirement was being implemented in her Monterey County area schools. And so she filed public records requests and was able to eventually find a 541 page document about how the schools were implementing ethnic studies. And, you know, the left will always claim that that critical race theory is not being taught in the schools, that it's only being taught in law schools or graduate schools and that sort of thing. And they'll try to obfuscate, you know, the issue. But if you look at this document that Kelly found, she didn't just find one reference to critical race theory or two references. She found 44 references to critical race theory in the implementation of this ethnic studies requirement in California. So it's really important for parents to be able to use these tools that are available to the public and that are effective in terms of finding out what exactly the schools are doing with curriculum, what they're doing with contracts, for example, hiring diversity, equity, and inclusion consultants. That's a whole industry now. And basically that's CRT under a different name. And we profiled another mom named Azra Nomani, an immigrant mom from India who is Muslim, whose father marched with Mahatma Gandhi against British colonialism. And yet she's against critical race theory. And she actually filed 200 of these public records requests to find out about the contracts in her schools that were approved to hire these diversity, equity, and inclusion consultants. It's a big racket and with a lot of taxpayer money. So the use of these public records requests are really important. And I think finally, people are, these parents are running for school board. And I think that's one of the important phenomenon that we've seen after this explosion of critical race theory revelations in these school districts is that parents are now not just complaining about it, they're actually doing something in terms of going out and actually taking control of the school board to ensure that they get that type of teaching out of the classroom. And you've seen dozens of school boards across the country, from coast to coast, not just in red states, but blue states as well. In my own home state here in California, we've seen pro-parent majorities flip school boards. And so parents are running for school board, they're winning these races, and they're changing policy. In fact, one of the pro-parent majority school boards here in California, once they flipped the board in November, the very first thing they did at their very first meeting in January was to pass a resolution banning CRT in the classroom in those in their district. So we profile a fellow named Ryan Gerdusky, who is the head of 1776 Project PAC, which is a project that donates only to pro-parent school board candidates, especially those who are against CRT. And he's had an incredible success record just in the last couple of years all across the country.
I want to ask you sort of the hard question, which is, how much of an impact do you think this movement is having? I mean, you know, the long march through the institutions took decades. We just woke up maybe after 2020. Now you're seeing a lot of activity, whether it's school board races or FOIA requests or what have you. I mean, are we starting to turn the tide? Is this, you know, a big change? I mean, do you think the schools are just going full force and just kind of ignoring the parents? What kind of impact do you think this movement is happening now?
Well, I think that it is having an impact. I mean, first of all, I mean, as I said, I mean, where you have these pro-parent majorities on the school boards, they actually are changing policy. And so, you know, yes, you know, when you've got termites in the woodwork, you know, it's hard to like get those termites out. I mean, and it is true that you can pass a statewide anti-CRT ban, and, you know, you might be able to take over the school board and, you know, pass an anti-CRT resolution. But again, you know, it's like ensuring that the people who are supposed to carry out those laws and those resolutions, actually implement them honestly in the classroom. And that's one thing that we're going to have to see going forward, is how honestly are these requirements now going to be carried out. I do think that one of the things that will help in this regard is, because I think this is a multi-front war, right? It's not just the parents running for school board and you're relying on that. It's not just the governor. Let's say, you know, I know Sarah Huckabee and others have, pushed for anti-CRT, banned statewide. But it's also, implementing things like school choice, to give parents a greater opportunity to choose the type of education that best meets the needs of their kid. And if they don't want their kid to be indoctrinated, they have that opportunity to, take their state funding and go to some other type of education opportunity that, will not indoctrinate their child. And I think that one of the things you see is that you're seeing more states that are implementing those sorts of programs. Arizona last year just implemented a universal education savings account program. You're seeing lots of proposals now all across the country, not just in red states, purple states, others, have wider school choice. I think that if you have wider school choice, not only will it help the parent avoid the indoctrination, but I think it also puts pressure on the public schools, because all of a sudden their customer base, is leaving, and the money that's tied with their customers is also leaving. And therefore they have to respond then. If the reason why the kids are leaving is not just because the test scores are lousy, but because parents are worried about the indoctrination, then the market theory would tell you that these schools would have to respond to that demand by parents for a non-ideological education for their kids. And I think, if we see widespread school choice implemented all across this country, I think that may be one of the ways to really leverage a change in the classroom.
Well, and it's about finding the best fit for a child, right? The best fit school experience for a child.
We'll be back with more Take Back Our Schools right after this.
Hello, I'm Dennis Neal, and here's what's bugging me. The media are burying some of the biggest scandals of our lifetime, and I'm here to call them out on it and make fun of them for it. The Twitter files and government censorship, the Biden documents, the Hunter laptop, the lies of the FBI in the Russiagate hoax, China spy balloons and toxic chemical burn-offs. Join me to hear things no other journalist will dare tell you. All that and more on What's Bugging Me, available for download and streaming every Thursday right here on the Ricochet Audio Network and wherever you get your podcasts.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.
I was really glad to see in your book that you profiled a student, and because it really brought home to me the effect that this, all of this indoctrination, all of the ideological exercises have on these kids. I think I highlighted most of his chapter. So I'm talking about Joshua. Can you tell us a little bit about him and his experience, and also how is he doing? Because it was, quite harrowing, sounded like.
It was quite traumatic. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up, Beth, because I mean, one of the things we wanted to do is not just profile people where it was adults telling you about what was happening in their kids' class. We wanted to actually have a student who was telling us what their firsthand experience was living through critical race theory in the classroom. And so Joshua, who we profiled, telling us about experiences he had to live through in middle school. He's in high school now, But in middle school, he was forced to undergo critical race theory exercises in a leadership class that he took. Now, he thought leadership meant that, oh, you know, I'll do things that will help the community, that sort of thing. But what he found out was a lot of it was critical race theory, social justice type of issues, and the types of exercises he had to go through were really appalling. So, for example, he told us about one exercise called the privilege walk, where the teacher lined up all of the kids shoulder to shoulder, and the teacher would call out a privilege trait, like, I am white, I am male, I am Christian. And if that trait applied to you, you had to take a step forward, from that line. And every time a trait was then called out, if that applied to you, kept going forward and forward. And he was the only white male in the class. So he felt as though he was
singled out. Yeah.
Singled out, and that he was going to be persecuted. He was going to have negative attention brought to bear on him over things he had no control over. He has no control over his race, his sex, his religion, whatever it is. And so therefore, you know, why should he be singled out from the rest of the class? In fact, what he told us was that it felt like they were all in a criminal lineup. And, then these are seventh and eighth graders who are being forced to do this. And, and kids who, are at that stage, and we all remember middle school, it's a tough time in middle school. And then to be singled out for negative attention like that in front of your whole class, you can only imagine how that must have made him feel. And, there were lots of other things that he had to go through. Like, for example, he had to do an art project where he had to draw a person's face while looking at the person, but without looking at the paper on which he was drawing the face. And so the teacher asked him afterwards, what did he learn from the lesson? And he told the teacher, well, I learned that you don't have to be perfect to do art. And the teacher's reply was just insane, really. The teacher said, well, perfectionism is white supremacy. And he said, what? And she said, perfectionism, either or thinking, and right or wrong answers, and objectivity, those are all traits of white supremacy. And he said, and then good for Joshua that he stood up to this teacher and asked her, well, what evidence do you have that that's the case? And what's interesting is that the teacher really didn't have any answer to that. She didn't have any evidence to back up why perfectionism and all these other traits were supposedly part of white supremacy culture. And it was obvious to him and also to me as the interviewer that this teacher was indoctrinated too, was just repeating back what she had learned in some professional development course or teacher curriculum course in the teacher college. You know, what I talked to you, Andrew, about, that this person was just basically a drone. Mm-hmm. Who was repeating back leftist talking points to this student. Thankfully, Joshua was courageous enough to stand up for it. But think of all the other kids who just, listen to this type of propaganda, which is baseless, unsupported, and yet it's thrown out there as if it were gospel. And they then swallow it hook, line, and sinker. And that's what's going on in our classes. And so it was important for us to be able to show the experience of a young, impressionable young, a student at the middle school age, and that it's not just something that is going on in a high school senior government class. This is something that's happening to young kids.
Was it hard to find someone to speak out? I know Joshua is a pseudonym, so he's obviously anonymous, but what was it hard to find someone who's willing to have the courage to speak out?
No, something, it's like you ask around and then, people will talk to you. We used Joshua, but we had, the opportunity to talk with other kids as well. And, they were willing too. I mean, we just thought Joshua's story was particularly compelling. And as the chapter indicates, and, what Beth mentioned, that you underlined, most of what Joshua said. I mean, his was perhaps one of the most incredible interviews we did for this entire book. because he was able to be so articulate about his experiences. And, you know, really, it was, you know, just basically transcribing his interview. We had to do very little editing on it because it was so compelling. But we had
and so common sense. I mean, he just he so observed just what was happening and the silliness and saw right through it. And that other kids did, too. It's actually really it's encouraging because I think a lot of us see what's happening in these classrooms and we're worried that, oh, our kids are getting ensnared in this and they're going to come home and we won't recognize them, et cetera. And so it was I found it encouraging that actually, you know, trust the kids a little bit that they do. They are seeing through it and that all is not lost.
Yeah. And I agree that a lot of kids do see through it and they certainly, you know, may not become 100% convinced about this stuff. On the other hand, it's important to understand that even if this is causing, you know, a minority of kids to become, you know, kind of these a CRT social justice warrior.
Right. The drones. Well, right.
The drones. I mean, you just have to look at Antifa. Right. Antifa doesn't represent all of that generation. And yet, you know, it's they've been brainwashed into thinking along these lines. And so therefore, you know, it's troubling, even if it's only a minority that is being indoctrinated and then, you know, being influenced by it in their lives.
It is. And, you know, they also, there's an opportunity cost. And we've talked about this on this show, like all of the minutes that they are spending on this ideological stuff are minutes that they are not spending on actual academics. And even I think Joshua mentioned that in his interview, as well as these kids are leaving school unprepared to go pursue whatever dreams that they have afterward, which is a real shame.
Yeah, no, I think that that's right. I mean, you know, you just have to look at the performance of kids across the country. Late last year, the National Assessment for Educational Progress, which is like the national test on reading and math, came out, and performance just went over the cliff. I mean, it had been bad before COVID, but after COVID, you saw, you know, huge declines in an already pathetic level of proficiency in these basic subjects. So all across our country, kids are not performing up to proficiency, and that's going to have huge impacts, not only on them as individuals, but on America as a whole, because our economy depends upon people who are able to, you know, take, you know, very complex jobs, often cases in our economy, and we're not preparing these kids for it. And yet, instead of working on how to remediate these kids, we're spending a lot of time turning them into political warriors, ideological warriors instead. And I think that one of the reasons why is because it allows the adults in the system to point to something else as the cause of all the failure, right? It's not them. It's not the public education system fault that the kids are performing badly. We can blame it on systemic racism. That's what's causing them to perform poorly. And therefore, it takes the onus off of us, off of them as the people in the system who have caused these kids, unfortunately, to fail miserably in their basic subjects, that now it's not their fault, it's society's fault, it's America's fault. And I think that's another reason, too, why you're seeing this push to get rid of things like standardized tests, because that's an indicator of the failure of the system. And on the other hand, you see this push for CRT and all these other types of doctrines, which, you know, basically blame America first and not the system.
I want to follow up. Critical race theory, CRT, was obviously a hot button issue. I mean, it still is to some extent, but to a large extent, it's gotten overshadowed now by some of the gender and trans ideology that's happening in schools. And that has also motivated a lot of parents to start speaking up and speaking out. Do you see them as the same issue, as related, or as two separate issues?
Well, I think that, you know, they're connected in a certain way. Now, you know, we didn't study the gender issue for our book, but I will just say that, you know, it's those same school systems are pushing both, right? And so it's not surprising, I think, that those who are pushing CRT might also be pushing a lot of the gender ideology too. And I think that it's, you know, both in tandem are working to push parents to do something about it. And so, you know, I think that with regard to CRT, one of the reasons why it is such a hot button issue for so many parents, regardless of, you know, race, is because, you know, that ideology impacts everybody in the classroom, right? If you're saying that some of you kids are in an oppressed class and some of you kids are in an oppressor class, and, you know, all those kids are affected by this ideology. Now, you know, whether the gender, you know, issue affects every kid, you know, in that class, they may not identify as this or may not identify as that. You know, it's a, I think it's a little bit more of an open question, but at least in CRT, you know, everybody is affected. And I think that's why you saw so many people become so incensed over it. And not just white people who, you know, are put into the oppressor class, but also too, you know, so many non-white parents are offended that, you know, their kids are going to always be viewed as part of an oppressed class, and they have no self-agency, right? They have no ability to improve their position in life because they will always be condemned to mm-hmm. a life of oppression according to this theory. And so that basically it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. And that's what these non-white parents that we profile in the book are saying, is that you're basically consigning our kids to failure because of this ideology. And we want our kids to succeed. And that's what the message of America is, that regardless of your race or background, you have the ability to succeed in this society because of the freedom and liberty that this country was built upon.
Absolutely. It really is so patronizing. And I wonder if some of the people that do kind of espouse these ideologies even understand how patronizing they sound, because they're often white liberals. Well, Lance, thank you for writing this book and for coming on to tell us about it and highlighting these examples of parents, because we sure do need more of them to show up and speak out. So if anything, maybe because we've let parents take a back seat, that's brought us to this place. So we'll hope that your book helps give them some courage, and we appreciate you coming on. Again, the book is The Great Parent Revolt. So Lance Azumi of Pacific Research Institute, thank you.
Thanks very much. Great pleasure to be on your show and be able to talk with you and your listeners.
So it's interesting. I think we've had maybe a third of the people that were profiled in this book is guests. So now we mm-hmm. know we've got a good list for people going forward.
We do.
Other ones to have. It would be good to get a student. I mean, I know, you know, that Joshua that we talked about is anonymous, obviously, as I think mm-hmm. most kids would want to be, but it would be really interesting to have a student come on.
Or a recent grad. I mean,
who
is out of school. I actually have a couple ideas there. That was great. He was very, just such a warm person. And he must've enjoyed doing all of those interviews, but you know, it's funny. I knew pretty much the story of everybody except for Joshua, but it was nice to have them all in one place. And he did go a little bit deeper. So it's it's good. Especially if people are not familiar with some of the players in the parents movement. I think that's a good reference.
He said something interesting. The one thing I'll talk about, which is the one thing they maybe have in common is maybe not all of them. Immigrants.
I loved that. Yes, right. I jotted that down. So, I mean, that just that perspective is always refreshing. And it's kind of,
refreshing, but scary. Because I think where you see them coming from, a lot of them is a lot of these people left communist countries or their families left communist countries, whether it's Soviet Union or Eastern Europe or communist China. And I've heard from a lot of them, as Lance articulated, they see what is happening there happening here.
Yes,
and they never thought they came to this country to get away from what was happening there. And they never really thought what was happening there could happen here. So it's refreshing to some extent, but it's also really scary because seemingly the people that know what's going on here are the ones that saw it in communist countries. And that's the way we are headed with this.
I think we take things for granted. I think, you know, whether it's a couple generations, two generations in or 10, I think you fail to appreciate how different this country is. And so I think they see it with fresh eyes. And yes, they are seeing some very scary patterns. And so it would behoove us not all to wake up and pay attention and start showing up.
Agreed. There's something going on at your school?
Yeah, well, the gender unicorn reared its horn, so I've got to deal with that. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it has, it's kind of thinking back, you know, 2017, so it's been, 6 years now. It has continued. I think we've been successful in exposing it and helping other people see it. So it's no longer kind of being those lone voices in the wilderness. Now, a lot of people are, you know, with us and sending emails and questioning. But there's still a ways to go. So yes, so never a dull moment. So yes, there'll be a lot.
But a lot of the conversation has, as you've just said, has gone from kind of the race issues to the gender issues. I mean, that's
yes,
both in terms of what's going on in schools and in terms of what parents are concerned about right now.
Yeah, no, I've definitely noticed that as well. So maybe in the future, Lance or someone will write a similar book about stories of parents that are coalescing around trying to address these gender ideologies issues in their schools, because that is going to be an issue for time to come. Well, I think with that, we're going to thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed today's show, please share it, give us a positive review, and do please join us again. So on behalf of Andrew Gutman, this is Beth Feely, and we will be back soon with another episode of Take Back Our Schools.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.